You're listening to a special showcase episode of the Round Table Podcast. 20 minutes with John Miro. Hello, literary alchemists. I'm Dave Robison.
And I'm Brian Humphrey.
And you're listening to a special showcase episode of the Roundtable Podcast, 20 Minutes With.
20 Minutes With is a segment in which Dave and I have the great honor to share the microphone with some fabulously talented people, and today is certainly no exception.
Indeed. In fact, we're continuing this intermittent international vibe, Bri.
It's fabulous.
I know. I'm kind of digging it myself. So let me, I know everybody's already clicked the link. You know who this guy is, but let me do my intro. I kind of feel like, was it Jeff Bellamy from A Knight's Tale playing Geoffrey Chaucer?
Yes, I'm
comparing myself to Geoffrey Chaucer.
Well, or to the character.
Geoffrey Chaucer, exactly. Geoffrey Chaucer.
Yeah, well, I do think that probably half of our audience tune in just to hear your introductions.
Oh, God, if only that were true. Regardless, ladies and gents who have tuned in, our guest host for this episode of 20 Minutes With is a wordsmith, an audio storyteller, a family man, and a complete and irreverent internet junkie. His aim, above all else, is to entertain, and he will and has, I have on good authority, bend words, physics, and reality to make this happen. His fiction is his growing list of fiction available in print, audio, and ebook includes Last Man Home, Asunder, The War Between Worlds, Harlan's Wake, The List, Marked Man, Mountain Challenge. Recently, he crowdfunded through Indiegogo book one of Enemy Lines, Subversion, which culminated in him munching on one of the most lethal peppers available in South America. And then he videotaped it, which is bold. And I was shocked to learn that there's a book about mule deer of Mesa Verde National Park, but it turns out that wasn't from him after all. So scratch that last bit. Friends, if you go to his website, to call it a cornucopia of podcasting awesomeness is a gross understatement. When you stroll into servingworlds.com, you have strolled into a world of amazing interviews, awesome serialized audio fiction, insightful commentary and discourse on literally every aspect of both podcasting and the writer's craft. It is astonishing the breadth and scope of the work he's done. Plus, he's Canadian, which I guess is very important. So let's go ahead and welcome to the Skype line, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. John Miro. John, I know you have so much going on, dude. Thank you for making the time to come join us at the round table.
Welcome aboard, my pleasure. My singular pleasure to sit with you two silver-tongued wordsmiths.
Silver-tongued wordsmiths. I like that. And as much as I'd like to talk about this Mule Deer of Mesa Verde National Park book, which is actually by Gary Miro. I was wondering if he was related to you or not.
No, I don't understand, but I'm sure Gary Miro, this very learned and astute writer of nonfiction, is probably more than a little nonplussed that his work is up there with a bunch of science fiction junk.
I'll tell you, go to Amazon and type in somebody's last name, you get all kinds of funky shit. But we digress. Let's not fritter about with random discussions.
Let's fritter about with me.
Yeah, definitely. And that's exactly why we're here. I'm going to set the timer here and try and hold ourselves to 20 minutes. I'll fail miserably, but that's okay. John, first question for you in this 20 minutes with. I recently ran across, again, servingworlds.com, fucking wow. The line, I kept hitting page down to go down and down and down, and more stuff kept filling up. It is astonishing, the scope of your inquiry and the caliber of the guests that you've worked on and the scope of your work. And I wanted to put this to you, because it's something that I'm curious about. You say that your goal is above all else to entertain. And I read recently on a blog post an interesting description, a definition. Entertainment makes us feel good. Art, on the other hand, transforms us. Now, having read your work, I it's certainly entertaining, but the depth, the character arcs, and the stories that you tell have a transformative aspect to them. And I'm curious, do you agree, first of all, with that assessment of, that entertainment makes us feel good and art transforms us? And if so, how much of that motivation of art do you invest in your work?
Well, motivation of art, I'll take, but I won't take art. Neil Gaiman and several other fine gentlemen have very clearly said that's for other people to decide down the road. But it's definitely something you want to aspire to. I aspire to telling the most insightful entertainment that I can. I want to have you on the edge of your seat, and I want to have you following along. I want you to laugh, and I want you to kind of pull back every once in a while when you read my stuff. And if I'm very, very lucky, then I've done some stuff that's gonna make you think. Because I know there's been a few times I've written and I've said, oh, that's a literary gem. I must keep that. But first and foremost, I want to tell a story. I want it to be a page turner or a pixel flipper if you're reading on your Kindle. And I want it to be something that just sucks you in and makes you forget about everything else.
Okay. Do you think that just the simple act of storytelling is, by its very nature, a transformative experience?
It can be.
Do you feel that you have achieved that transformative aspect in some of your work, while other work is purely an entertainment, a feel-good event?
I think in some of my best stuff, the comments I've had from people and the feeling I've gotten, it's no different than if you're using a blowtorch and scrap metal to make a sculpture. It can transform you when you build it. So for me, it's definitely been transformative. I won't put words in anyone else's mouth, and I hope and I strive to reach that. But the only way anybody can ever make something like that is to forget about that. If you have if you've got a welder in one hand and a couple pieces of scrap metal in the other, you have to make that seam hold. You have to put the words in the right order. Or worms, maybe.
Or worms, sure, absolutely.
You're a master angler, you still have to worry about getting that worm on the hook.
That's
and if
right.
I get the reader on the hook, it's because I did the job right.
Oh, look at what you just did.
That was
brilliant.
Awesome.
Oh, my God. We're in the hands of a professional. Please speak on, sir.
Oh, now you've ruined it. There's no way I can follow that. But the best art is occurred when you're not trying to create art. It's when you're trying to get through what you're doing.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. See, every now and again, John, we have epiphany moments in these 20 minutes with, and I just had one. That's outstanding. That's exceptional. So let me ask you this, let's talk specific craft. We've had several writers on the show, several authors on the show who have spoken of the abysmal status of the first draft and the work that goes into transforming it from first draft into something that's actually presentable and beta readable and so on. And I'm curious, when you look at your first draft, what do you find there that needs to be cleaned up? What are the things that you instinctively go for that once you apply the editing mind to it, you're reworking or you consistently have to rework or pay attention to?
Well, I want to say something really cool and special. Like, I don't have first drafts. It's all gold. But
liar.
I have a first draft that I think is pretty good because it has the essence of the story I wanted to tell. But it usually introduces characters because I don't care how special and talented you are, you can't have plot without a character to actually further the plot. And those characters usually, and I won't say they speak to me, but they usually come with their own sets of problems that it's just like a physics equation. If you have a person here that likes to shoot a gun and you have a person here that likes to get in the way of a bullet, then you're going to have a story. And then you just have to follow what they're doing and be honest with it. So if you take the art out of it again, and I like the art, but we'll take it out again and use it as a physics experiment. Once you've got the components for your story, your lab experiment, you just have to be faithful about, well, what would the real reaction be? Not what I want to have happen then, it's fan fiction, but what'll really happen, and it usually surprises you.
Very cool. And surprises you in what way?
It surprises me in who's going to live and who's going to die, who's going to be the hero and who's going to, if not become a protagonist, become dead weight or a problem for who really turns out to be the protagonist.
So you're a discovery writer.
I'd love to say that I outline the hell out of everything, and I do, and then I throw it all out and follow my gut.
Wow.
So, awesome.
So the outline basically serves as a rough structure, but once the keys start clicking, anything goes.
You got to follow that stream.
Very cool.
So to that same end, you use a lot of very specific themes. In Asunder, one very specific one is the racial tension. Do you plot that at all ahead? Do you think about theme ahead of time, or is theme something that just sort of happens in your writing?
Thanks for saying that. I appreciate that. That's something you took from it. What I went with in Asunder is I want to write something steampunk. I can't write steampunk. Steampunk is a great aesthetic, but it's not a story. Some people are very good at putting a great story in a steampunk setting, mm-hmm. but I can't work that way. So I said, well, okay, what are the elements of steampunk? For Asunder, I was thinking of this. And I came up with, it's in the past, it uses newfound technology, and it's usually gritty, and there's usually problematic things, because as with pre-industrial revolution and steam and the age of empire, it was a pretty gritty time, and people were getting eaten by the cogs of the machine. And I took all that and I said, okay, the best example I could think of this, and again, it wasn't insightful, it was just thinking it through, was H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds.
Right.
Okay.
And I said, all right, what else is happening around that time? And I just kind of extrapolated. I didn't set out to write I guess it's an alternate history, but I said, okay, Civil War in America. There was a lot of machines, a lot of steel boats in rivers that were just cannonading the hell out of their countrymen. Okay, so let's have a Civil War survivor who thinks that the world can't get any worse, but then of a sudden, the whole world turns into be the same battleground. Okay, well, why don't we have it be somebody that was on the losing end? Well, at least not the losing end, but the people that were being fought about, that were being ground into the gears the most, which were the slaves. So I had somebody survive, and since I'm Canadian, he got out of that mess. But unfortunately, my surviving slave, Marcus, became a Canadian who was smuggling things across the ocean to make his money from Halifax for rich people, and he got stuck over here during the War of the Worlds, and that's where I was stuck. What better person to have as your poster boy for humanity than a former slave when aliens come to enslave everyone else?
Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah, that's awesome. Another thing that really struck me in Asunder was your handling of action sequences. And I belong to a writer's group. One of the things that we talk about all the time is how difficult it is to write an action sequence, because you have so many important details and pieces of action and motions that you have to portray without sacrificing pacing or letting the whole thing become just a jumbled mess of descriptive movement. How do you do it?
One of my favorite writers is a man named Nathan Lowell, and in this one way, I will say the art just comes out. He says he sees it like a movie in his head, and I just imagine the very beginning of the scene, and then I just put everything in motion, and I try to follow through as faithfully as I can. Again, I'm a big believer in if you've got enough elements on the page, and you stir it right, you have the right heat, it'll come out the right way. Hey, this is maybe why my website is called Serving Worlds, because I'm really food-based today. I've never really thought of it as a struggle for me. This is my humble brag. The action scenes come easy to me. It's just something that once, and again, maybe it's the whole theory of how I write. I put the pieces that I want to write down, and then I track it the way the story needs to go. And it's resulted in entire extra subplots or completely new characters, or people that I thought were going to carry a whole novel being killed in the first 800 words.
Right. Do you find sometimes that your characters, that you have characters that get injured that you weren't planning on harming that early, but just in the course of writing that sequence, somebody's hand gets blown off and then you have to deal with that through the rest of the story?
I thought one of the three main characters in the novel that I crowdfunded, Enemy Lines, I thought that that was going to be a woman named Laura. And she dies in the scene I introduce her in.
Whoops.
And I was very angry because I had a lot of stuff set up for her.
Right.
But I couldn't take the words off the page. And I think what happened was it created a better character. So we'll call it, I don't know, writer's intuition, or I got really lucky. But her very mousy, sucked into the adventure female partner, her wife, became a very capable character, which she would have never done if that hadn't happened.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with John Miro after this brief promotional break.
I crouched low in the dim light, my gaze sweeping across the ruined grandeur of the lost temple of Abu Harabi. Before me on a stone altar, still black with blood spilled from 1,000 human sacrifices, lay the Tablet of Infinite Delights. I lifted it carefully and placed it in my satchel, and it was then I heard the slithering scrape of 100 serpents. I turned, drawing my pistol, and gaped at the horror that had risen before me. A black, tentacled beast from my darkest nightmare. It rose higher and higher, and I feared for my very soul. But the thing's bulk crashed into the ceiling, collapsing it and allowing me to scrabble away with my life, my sanity, and my prize. Later, I examined it, translating the ancient script. "For adventure of a bygone era," the tablet read, "tune in to Protecting Project Pulp, a weekly podcast of classic pulp tales guaranteed to get your pulse pounding. You can tune in to the thrills of Protecting Project Pulp starting Tuesday, July 17th. Visit their website at www.protectingprojectpulp.com for more information. Protecting Project Pulp, when adventure truly begins. Now, let's get back to the conversation with John Miro.
Well, and let's explore that just a little bit, because I've heard other writers say what you just described is complete bullshit.
Oh no.
Well, you know, honestly, I'm a Discovery writer. I think Brian is too.
So we
understand empathically, what you're describing, but how does that happen? I mean, you're writing along, chicka chicka chicka, and all of a sudden, what? The plot, the direction that you saw the scene going in, you suddenly on a whim, you know, kill off a character that you obviously were consciously planning on extending well into the book. And it's not a whim. What is that makes your story veer so dramatically from your intent?
You know, fair enough. It's you could call it a bullshit call, but
I'm not at all. I'm saying other people feel that way, and I would like to be able to articulate it in such a way that maybe those people that do consider it bullshit could understand it better. Because I agree with you.
Okay. I've had it happen. We're getting tired of shooting them.
Yes, exactly. And the bodies are piling up. So if we can convince them and explain it to them, that would be better.
Okay. The first thing for me, and I can only speak for me.
Sure.
I love fantasy. I've got 3 trunked fantasy novels. I'm an atheist. I can read other people's fantasies and I can believe it completely, but I just can't seem to produce it on my own anymore.
Huh.
My wife is religious. I have a very good relationship to people that can believe whatever they want, and people can believe if they want that Discovery writing is hocus pocus too. But I think the analogy I gave earlier about the physics of the pieces you put on the table, you have to be faithful to that, is a lot more truthful than the notion that the characters tell me what to do. The characters will tell you what to do if you have a role-playing game and you have the rules there in front of you, because when you create that mage and you roll his skill level, you can't bullshit that away.
Right.
But
right.
There's other people at that table. Whatever is on that table is physics in motion. And that's where the magic, that's where the real beauty of a role-playing game or any kind of strategy in the real world or writing comes from. The fact of the matter is you play the hand you're dealt, and that's called inspiration. It comes out because when you're surprised as a writer, it's because what you have to work with, you may not have intended to play with it, but you can either trunk that novel and try again with a whole new set of rules, or you niggle at that string and you pull it and you see where that thread goes, and by God, that's the fun of writing.
Oh, hell yeah. And that's an excellent point, because, you know, at Balticon, we'd asked everyone, is talent something that you're born with or something that you acquire over time? And we got some great responses, even from you, John. And, you know, I think I think what you just described makes perfect sense. If you put those set pieces out there and you define them and you identify them very clearly and you understand them, then you know, your subconscious, your creative muse, whatever you want to call it, that part of your brain that sees how things fit together and is constantly playing with how they fit together is working even beyond the conscious awareness that you have in your conscious mind. And as you start working with this, then yeah, you're on some level, you have some part of your mind has said, you know, Laura's got to die and she's got to die now.
Yeah.
Because it fits perfectly. That makes perfect sense to me. Brian, are you down with that?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that's also, we've talked about this before a long time ago, about how important it is to not put your piece down for very long, because you start to lose that inspiration. And I think part of that is you have so many things that you've put in that are floating around in your mind, and you might have a vase sitting on a table in one scene. And as long as that's in the back of your head, later on, somebody walks in and grabs that vase and beats someone over the head with it, and you didn't intend that to happen. But because it's fresh and because you've been playing with it recently, you know, your brain works on that level. And yeah, I agree. Yeah. I think it's, you know, spontaneous inspiration.
So John, how long after you completing a first draft do you start your first revisions?
Traditionally, what I'll do is I'll have two things on the go all the time. One fresh thing that I'm writing and one thing that I'm editing. In the last 3 years, that's changed to where I have one thing that I'm writing, one thing that I'm, now I say the editing is the second pass, and one thing that I'm podcasting. And the act of podcasting is a third pass.
Okay.
I don't have any major mechanical failures in the third. Thank God I haven't pulled a Scott Sigler Nocturnal. but I have added entire passages, changed passages, and found an interminable mound of typos and incorrect sentences. When you read aloud, oh my God, that's a great. So it's a three pass process for me to write.
So really,
usually it's a few weeks in between each phase at least, and I'm trying to fire on great guns the last couple of years to get stuff out.
So really the podcasting stage is at least in large part an editorial pass.
It is.
Now, and of course it's a marketing pass, which, you know, we all acknowledge, and it's a great way to do that. Is there more to it than that for you, the podcasting?
Okay. We're moving away from the mechanics of writing to, is podcasting more than just a trick pony to get readers?
Well, and actually, I'm looking more for your creative muse, because I know that a lot of our listeners, if they're not podcasting now, if they're listening to this podcast, then it might be in their mind. And I think it's important to get the full scope of what podcasting does. Yes, it's marketing. Yes, it's editing. Is there a creative mojo underneath it? I guess that's what I'm asking you.
I love it. like many people that write, I have a background in acting. I went to a theater school in another life 20-odd years ago, and they said, you know, you stick with this acting thing, and you don't starve, and in 10 years, you'll grow into a character actor, and you might make a living. And I said, bye, see ya.
not interested.
But I've always wanted to, and even before that, I got into acting because I wrote things. I wrote plays when I was in high school that my school would produce. And then I would go out and try to be an actor. That was a step backwards, but it was what society thought. You got to be a cooperative part of a society. Nah, I want to hide in my room and write. But I still have this part of my body that loves to talk to other people, that loves to explore the writing process. And I've, like you, I've got a lot of podcast roundtables or interviews with other writers, mm-hmm. guest posts, because I'm fascinated by the process. And when I turn the mic on myself, it's performance. Anybody that's played some good jazz or done some improv theater, you feel the stuff come out of you. I've changed the wording of sentences because of the way they sound coming out of my mouth. But I also get, some would say too hammy, really into the performance. And I really enjoy, it changes the pacing, it changes the presentation. And I've got some of my readers that say, I love your writing. Keep writing so I can hear it, because that's better.
Awesome.
Well, I don't know about awesome, but I'll take both.
Oh, hell yeah.
I'm recording some work with, I can't reveal names now, but with ACX.com, I'm recording a couple of titles.
Awesome.
So I love that as a way to pay for diapers and writing time.
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, hell yeah. And Brian and I have both postulated that that actors, I won't say the blanket statement of actors write better stories, but do you think your background in performance theater has contributed to your skills as a writer?
Well, it's contributed to my skills as a reader and a narrator, and I think if you try to be a writer for a few years, you're exposed to things that do more for your writing than actual acting. You could sit there and say, well, what's my motivation in this scene? But no, you're much more beneficial to say, how would they like this scene? Or what kind of prop would I carry in this scene? Mm-hmm. Those things, those three-dimensionality, that aspect of words on a page are great, but once you hear a great writer brought to life by even a mediocre prop department, lighting and stage, is it going to be told in the round with audience all around you? Is it going to be told in the front of a proscenium arch? Thinking about it's a three-dimensionalizing of what you're putting on the page. And when you have that in your head, it makes everything that you put down clearer, crisper, hopefully richer.
Very cool. That's awesome. One last very quick question, John. You have a very large body of work that has dabbled in a variety of formats and presentations. I assume that you're still working on your craft, that you're always working on your craft. What are you working on now as a writer, and what are you doing to refine that aspect of your craft?
What I'm working on right now is a couple of sequels and a shared world anthology pitch. Each of those formats affects my writing. If I'm working on a sequel to Asunder, I'm working on a language and a sensibility to characters that is very different to myself. I'm working on creating people that are not comfortable exposing their emotions, high-fiving once they blow up a baddie. It's a very different kind of person. So what I strive for there, and it's kind of unique because I have a world that's been blown up, so that you'll have one or two characters that are bigger than life. But then the majority of the other people are still struggling to just have this old world sensibility about their interactions. So I'm working on that kind of framing. If I'm working on a sequel to Tools and Means, I'm working on a very dark interior monologue and way of seeing the world that is fever pitched. Mm-hmm. And if I'm working on yet another of my longest series, Enemy Lines, what I'm working on is multiple plot line juggling. So the beauty of this is I can go from one to the other and can stretch muscles in a different fashion all the time. They say that the best thing to do for writing, if you're stuck, is to do a writing exercise. Write 500 words on character today, write 500 words on a setting tomorrow. And I've got a wide enough range of pools to play in that I can easily jump from one to the other for a few days or weeks if I feel that I have that close to the surface, or if I'm struggling for that and it's a good idea to help work on that.
That's outstanding. That's gold, baby.
That's wow. What we strive for.
It is, exactly. And sadly, I'm watching the clock that has run out and run out a short while ago. What a shock. So I'm going to have to wrap this up. But John, holy crap, thank you, man, for the epiphany moment. That was awesome. The laughs, the giggles, and some genuine useful insights into the writer's craft. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you very much, guys. Also, thank you for putting something out that is something that you genuinely love. And since I've started listening, it's something that I genuinely love, too. You're contributing to everybody in the field.
Oh, God. You just touched my heart, dude. Thank you.
That's right.
I'm lying, but I have to be nice. Canadian. I'm Canadian.
I'm the guest. I got to say something nice. Yeah. That's very cool. Thank you. Well, and we will strive to continue to do so, because God knows we do love it. That must be why. Yep. Brian, any last words for John before we wrap this bad boy up?
No, I'm fascinated by the idea of balancing two different projects at the same time, because I don't do it very well. So,
oh, dude, it's so rewarding. Did I just say dude?
You did.
Go from like, I'm writing. Oh, I need to switch to the other hemisphere of my brain, so I'll do some editing. But actually stretching different muscles and forcing yourself to do things you're not comfortable with, it's what makes you better.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think my problem is I'm working on about 20 things at once, and so nothing ever gets done.
You might want to narrow that a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. But no, it's been awesome to have you on, and I think we'll either have to have you on again or just start stalking you through Twitter.
Okay. Yes.
And yeah. Because you used the word dude, I just got an email. You need to turn in your Canadian card because apparently Canadians don't use that word. So. Sorry.
Sacre bleu.
Sacre bleu. Friends, thank you so much for tuning in. As always, we're deeply grateful that you hit that play button. Whether it's the moment this thing dropped or 5 years from now, thank you so much. Feel free to swing out to iTunes if you're so inclined. Rate us. If you're feeling the writing muse upon you, drop a review. That always helps us. It's like buying us a cup of coffee, only it doesn't cost you anything, which is awesome.
It's a really good tasting cup of coffee, too.
Oh, yes. Very sweet. Very sweet. Yeah. You saw me turn into a puddle of mush when John said that nice thing. Just imagine the transformation that Brian and I will go through when we see your review. That would be fabulous.
That's right. So,
and if you've got some comments for John, leave them on the comment for the post on the website. Drop us a line at the table at roundtablepodcast.com. We would so very much love to hear from you. We're still waiting on gathering enough information to do a listener feedback show. But I think Brian, all of our listeners just, they go right.
Yeah.
And is that a good idea? Writing. Is that what you recommend?
Absolutely. Go write.
Bam! There it is, friends. Absolutely. And if you're not going to write to us, then by all means, write that magnum opus. Write that short story. Write that amazing thing that's burning in your heart. Put it on paper and make it real. We would love to see that, too. Stay tuned in a couple of days. We'll have John back. We'll workshop a rockin' story and continue the fun, because the fun must flow. Until then, you guys be cool. We will talk to you again soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com. Or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast. Or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.